I don't know about you. I've just been blown away by these last few weeks as we've started this series, The ...Encounter. It was just been incredible to hear the stories emerge. If you weren't here a couple of weeks ago, I spoke about the unexpected encounter, and the amount of people who have come up to me and kind of, because I use this phrase, it won't make sense if you weren't here, but I talked about the fact that God opened the mouth of the ass, and I mean by that a donkey if you weren't there, and it's been amazing the amount of stories that have emerged about people saying, oh man, I had this ass speak to me the other day, and they're just kind of like, whoa, just kind of open to the way that God was speaking. And then last week, if you were here, Heather talked about the deliberate encounter, just this idea that anytime, anywhere, what does it mean to actually speak out and say to God, show me your glory, show me your glory. I want to see your glory. I want to hold that weight, that significance. That's what that word glory means. And I want to actually pursue you deliberately, because this whole series is about building encounter into our everyday lives, building encounter, expecting encounter when it comes to our everyday lives. And that's why I'm really excited, because I'm hearing these stories of people who suddenly are seeing their lives, their faith, their will differently, because it's almost like the box that I mentioned in week one of their preconceptions about the way that God operates and the way we ought to operate has just been shattered. And new things are occurring, and that's really exciting. Now, it's kind of interesting. These last couple of weeks, we've been talking about really nice encounters. Like, we love the encounter that's unexpected. You know, it might take us by surprise, but we like it because God spoke, and we're like, cool, that's awesome. And we love the kind of encounter where we're like, show me your glory, and then God shows us his glory. We're like, oh, I like that. Well, tonight, I'm going to talk about the kind of encounter that we don't really want, but we have to talk about it because it's very real and very relevant. You see, because God doesn't just speak when we want him to. Sometimes God speaks at times when we'd rather he didn't. And so tonight I'm going to be talking about the necessary encounter. The necessary encounter. Because the crazy thing is, once you kind of know that there's something that's going on in your life, once you have this realization that maybe there's something going on in my life that isn't reflecting God's heart, that isn't reflecting his character, sometimes it means that God is actually wanting to actually have an encounter with us to call us out on that which is not of him. You know, sometimes the necessary encounter, and often the necessary encounter, isn't a pleasant encounter. I was thinking back, actually, this is a couple of years ago. I love this opening illustration. This will really set you up for dinner. But I remember that actually the staff, we'd gone to this Crossway staff dinner, right? It was like a staff dinner to kick off the year. And this was a couple of years ago. We had this lovely meal, and we had some really good times. But lo and behold, I got home, and I started not to feel so well, yeah? And, you know, after a meal, sometimes you're like, maybe I overate. But then you kind of hit with this realization that maybe it's something more. It's like, oh, actually, I don't think this thing is going away. And you start to kind of think, and you kind of go, maybe it's food poisoning, right? Now, there's two stages of grief with food poisoning. Stage number one is recognizing, oh, my goodness, I think I've got food poisoning. And there's the pain that's associated with that itself. But then there's the second stage of mourning. And that's the reality that you know it's not going to be a good night, yeah? That's the second stage of mourning, because you know that there's something that has to happen. It's necessary, right? It's not pretty, but it's necessary. And it has to happen because, you know, because if it doesn't happen, I'm probably going to die. And a couple of years ago, I just remember feeling in my gut, I'm like, I've got this food poisoning. And of course, there I was, up at 1 a.m. puking in the toilet, destroyed one. You know, and then you kind of try to go back to sleep and you get that pain in your stomach again. You go, here we go, round two. Choose another toilet. Boom, that one's gone as well. And you're just knocking out. This is why people have multiple toilets in their house for just these moments. And I'm just like puking every 2 hours on the dot. Couldn't get a wink of sleep. And I kid you not, Megan found me in the morning. She found me in the morning. At the base of our stairs, we had this little landing, right? This little landing at the base of our stairs. And I was kind of crawled up in the fetal position. Cameras follow me. With my head resting against the lower stair like this. And she found me. I think it was about 6 a.m. in the morning. And I wish she had taken a photo. Because it would have made a great sermon illustration. Nevertheless, you have to imagine, but maybe you don't because you've had food poisoning and you know how bad it is. But this is the truth. sometimes we have to go through these necessary experiences and these necessary moments because ultimately they're positioning us or they're actually transitioning us from a place that would have otherwise been really, really destructive. And this is how God operates. There are necessary encounters that God has with us, and we need to be aware of them. And so tonight, as we push into this idea of the necessary encounter, I want to talk about ingredients of the necessary encounter. These things, these markers that can capture our attention so that we're not ignorant to how God might want to speak to us. So let me pray, and then we'll get stuck into Daniel chapter 5. God, I want to thank you that you're a God who cares enough not to let us go down paths that would ultimately be destructive. And so God, as we push into this topic tonight, this almost quite confrontational topic, God, I want to pray that we would have open hearts, that we would be honest with ourselves and honest with you, and that ultimately you would speak to us, convict us of those areas where you want to encounter us for our good. In your name, amen. Cool, so we're going to be looking at Daniel chapter 5. So if you've got a phone or a Bible, feel free to navigate to Daniel chapter 5. We're actually going to push through most of this chapter. I've chosen, Balaam and the talking donkey like a couple of weeks ago, and this time we're going to be talking about Belshazzar's feast, okay? And this is another wacky story, but it has this deep, profound truth that I think that we can learn a lot from. Just to give a bit of context, Belshazzar, I'm going to call him Shaz from now on because it's such a long name, and I'm sure all his mates called him Shaz anyway. So the thing is with Shaz's feast is that he was the king of the Babylonians, okay? The king of the Babylonians, and he was the son of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, you may know that name Nebuchadnezzar because it's hard to say, but also because of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that story. And he was loving throwing people in the fire, but he had this kind of encounter or this kind of experience that kind of shifted his perspective. But lo and behold, we find his son, Belshazzar, or Shaz, and he's having this banquet. And what I want to do is, first of all, I just want us to note the character of Belshazzar. Maybe there was some stuff going on in his life that wasn't really up to God's scratch, right? So let's read just from verses 1 to 4. And it says this: King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Shaz was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles and his wives and his concubines might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines drank from them. And then not only that, as they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Now, if this in these like four verses doesn't paint a picture of the kind of character or some of the issues that were going on in Shaz's life, I don't think anything will. Because there were several sins, right, that were really taking root in his heart and in his life. And the writer of Daniel really wants to draw out and illustrate just how profound these were. And it should challenge us too to think about what's the state of our life. What is the state of our life? And I just want to identify a few things from Shaz's life. Now, number one. Now, what was he doing having this banquet? You see, what we don't learn from this context at the moment, we only discover a little bit later, is that the city itself, the city that they were having the banquet in, was under siege. It was literally being attacked by Darius the Mede and by Cyrus the Great. These two generals, along with their armies, were attacking this city. Okay, so this isn't just kind of like, hey, times are good, we're really enjoying ourselves, let's throw a banquet. This is like, oh, our city's being attacked, but let's throw a banquet. And now you might be thinking, well, what's going on there? Is this guy just lazy? Well, no, actually, Shaz, the issue with him was that he was actually complacent. See, because the Babylonians, of which he was the king, had this idea that they thought their city walls were impregnable. So they had these massive city walls around their cities, and they just figured, no, our city walls are too strong. There's no way that the armies could come in. We are just too strong. And so there was this complacency that you can see emerging from Belshazzar. He's just like, you know what? We're getting attacked, but I'm going to throw a party because I can, and I don't care. And you can hear the pride and you can hear the arrogance, right, that comes with that. Just like, yeah, they can keep attacking. These walls are never going to come down. How easy is it for us to fall into some of those traps, right? It's like, oh no, things are good. Now, I know that there's some attacks. I know that there's going to be temptations that come my way, but life's good. I'm just going to remain a bit complacent. Okay, second thing that we notice is that he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple in Jerusalem. Now, these gold and silver goblets, had profound significance. There was profound awe and honor associated with these things. These were part of the temple and temple practices back in Israel. These were set apart for God and his purposes and for the sacrifices and for the offerings, right? Drink offerings. They'd pour out drink offerings to God. These were sacred tools. And there is Belshazzar. Not only is his city being attacked, but he's cool with it. He says, you know what? Grab those goblets. Grab those sacred items, because you know what I'm going to do with these sacred items? I'm going to drink out of them. And not only am I going to drink out of them, I'm going to let my wives drink out of them. I'm going to let my nobles and my mates drink out of them. And even my concubines, I'm going to let drink out of them. Now, you have to understand that this was a desecration of these holy items. Absolute desecration. And there was this profound sense of irreverence, right? What should have been honored, Belshazzar just didn't care about. There was this irreverence that emerged. So not only was Belshazzar complacent, he was also irreverent. But then there's a third thing that emerges. And it says in verse 4, as they drank the wine, while the city was being attacked, while using these goblets that they shouldn't have been, as they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. And later on we learn, these gods are described as that which are dead, because they have no voice, they have no air, they have no life in them. And so in the midst of it, there was this idolatry. So not only is there complacency, not only is there irreverence, there is idolatry. And all of these things from Belshazzar emerged from this place of pride. Pride. This was the trajectory that he was on. I know I'm spending a bit of time on this, but we really need to understand where he started. This is the trajectory he was on. It was pride. Complacency comes from pride, because I cannot be attacked and be defeated. Irreverence comes from pride. I can use what I want because I am on top. And even idolatry comes from a place of pride, especially when it comes to worshiping and praising that which is dead, because it's kind of this gluttony. It's this lip service. Oh yeah, I believe in God, but I don't really care about it because I'm busy here drinking wine. And there's no power there. And you can see that Belshazzar was heading down this path of destruction. And I don't know about you, sometimes when I think about my own life and when I think about some of the circumstances I go through, I know that there's times when suddenly, I don't even mean to, but sometimes like pride can well up within me. Or maybe I start making a few decisions or engaging with people or communicating with people in a particular way, and I know it's not healthy. Maybe some cynicism, yeah, starts to birth. You know that cynicism comes from a place of pride. We think that we know best. And sometimes these things can start emerging, and we need to be on our guard. Because when it comes to the necessary encounter, when it comes to this idea that God is going to encounter us because he needs to encounter us, it's necessary for him to encounter us, the necessary is God's response to the known. It's his response to those things that we already know are inside of us that God doesn't look fondly on. So what is it for us? What is our rebellion? Belshazzar had a few just there that were building up. But sometimes, and it's a sobering thing to consider sometimes, that we need to. It's like, is there anything right now that I'm a bit blind to? I'm a bit in denial about? It's like I've got most of my life over here, and that's looking pretty good and shiny. But this area over here, that temptation, that attitude, that relationship where there's bitterness rather than forgiveness. It's like that's looking good, but sometimes we can forget about this side of things. And actually, I don't use that term forget well, because I think we know it, right? We know that there's those areas of our lives, but we just deny it. We just kind of go, no. If we were asked to put this on a scale, it's like, I'm way better than that issue that's going on there. And yet it's that very issue that God sees and actually wants to respond to. Why? Because he loves us and he doesn't want us pursuing that trajectory. It's confronting, but it's necessary. I'm going to move on because this is where it starts to get crazy. So we've got Belshazzar, we've got Shaz, and he's not doing good stuff. It's all stacking up. Pride's overwhelming. And then we read in Daniel 5, chapter 5 and 6. Now, this is where it gets weird. You thought a donkey was weird. This is getting weird. Verse 5, suddenly the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched as the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale and he was so frightened that his legs became weak and his knees were knocking. Don't you love that? His knees were knocking. I thought that was reserved for rhymes, but it's here in the Bible. His knees were knocking. His face became white and his knees were knocking. But how weird is this? Suddenly in this banquet, suddenly in this circumstance where there was this arrogance and there was overwhelming sense, a hand, a human hand suddenly appears and starts writing in the wall. Now, I don't know how you picture that. I always think of like the Thing from the Addams Family. I don't know if that's like an outdated reference. But that's all I can think of. It's just like this hand kind of like, it would freak you out, right? But God was trying to get his attention. And maybe he needed to do that because he was so drunk. I don't know. But this thing just freaked him out. And it was this bold confrontation where God was trying to capture his attention. And you know what? The necessary encounter is a scary encounter. When we think about all the lovely encounters we have with God, when he speaks to us, when he inspires, when he provides, when he brings these words, actually the necessary encounter can be a really scary encounter because what God does is he shines a light on that piece of us that we wanted to deny, that we wanted to remain hidden, that we didn't want to identify with. And it scares us because suddenly something is revealed that we thought we had hidden. And yet God knew that it needed to be revealed because it was setting us down a path of destruction. You know, I remember, okay, this is really funny. I don't know why. Now, I wear contact lenses. For some reason, people find that bizarre. I'll be in a conversation with people and they'll be like, oh, do you wear contacts? And I'll be like, yeah. And they'll be like, really? I'm like, yeah. Is that so weird? You know, and for some reason, the conversation always goes like that. But I remember when I was in year 8, that's when I first started to lose my vision, right? Wasn't so clear, but I was in massive denial. So I still remember, right, sitting in the classroom and I would look at the board and I couldn't see a thing, let alone the fact that it was Indonesian class. So even if I could see it, I probably still wouldn't know what it said. But I remember I couldn't see a thing and I was in this massive case of denial because for some reason I was in year 8 and I thought glasses were lame. And so I remember sitting there and I would get my mate Josh, who would sit next to me. I'd be like, the teacher would go, Gavin, can you like translate or read this out? I couldn't read it. So I'd be like, Josh, what does it say? And he'd whisper it into my ear and then I'd say it out loud or translate it or whatever I needed to. And there was this massive case of denial. There was this blindness, right? I was blind. I couldn't see. And yet I was denying it. I was trying to push it back, right? But could you imagine if I denied it for the rest of my life? How many car crashes I would have been involved in? Actually, I wouldn't have even got my license. Could you imagine trying to petition? No, I can see. I can see. They're like, no, you can't. It wouldn't have happened. And I think the teachers knew it too. Probably because Josh kept having to whisper to me. But they knew it too. And so I think they just kept on asking me to read stuff off the board. And it was this process of them just breaking down my pride. It was necessary, right? It was absolutely necessary. And then I got contacts and fooled them all. But nevertheless, it was a necessary thing to take place because it wasn't going to work for me if I didn't get glasses, if I didn't get clarity around that piece of my life and whatever that thing is. And now I know that's the case with glasses, but we could equally say that there are areas of our faith and of our character that we are blind to, that we need confrontation around in order to move forward. Let's continue. Daniel chapter 5 verse 7, the king summoned the enchanters, the astrologers and the diviners. He said to these wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple, which is royal and regal, and have a gold chain placed around his neck so he gets some bling, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. So then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. So King Belshazzar became even more terrified and his face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. Isn't it just like, it's like there was this scary moment. And of course, what happens when we're confronted? What happens when we're scared? We kind of find other people to try and sort this out for us, right? And yet they couldn't work it out. And so he's getting more and more scared. He's like, oh, this is becoming more and more terrifying to me. And see, this is what happens. We get caught out. Our heart pounds in these moments when God encounters us necessarily, and suddenly he sheds light on these things. And the truth is, we know why. We know what God is trying to get our attention in regard to. Sometimes it's that God actually scares us to safety. He actually scares us to safety to a certain extent. And I don't mean this like some sort of like, you know, police officer where it's just like he's looking out for all the stuff that we're doing bad, and then as soon as we take one step out, he's just kind of smacking us down and making sure. You know, he doesn't always encounter us that way. But I'm convinced, and what I see over and over again in my own life and in other people's lives as well, is that when there's been a series of decisions made and when there's a trajectory being set, I think that God, because of his love and because of his pursuit of us, is intentional about necessarily encountering us. So that we stop. I love those words when the disciples asked Jesus how to pray. Some of the words that Jesus said was, pray to God and say, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. This is how Jesus understood the Father, right? Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. And so here we have Shaz, absolutely petrified, confronted with his own gluttony, confronted with his own arrogance, and not knowing what to do. He's searching for answers. Then we introduce Daniel. It says this in verse 10. The queen, hearing the voices of the king and the nobles, came into the banquet hall. May the king live forever, she said. Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. Isn't that what you want when you're scared? Just someone saying, don't be scared. Never works. But she says, she provides some practical advice too. Verse 11, there is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. Your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. He did this because Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, which is very similar to his name, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel, and he will tell you what this writing means. Okay, so we've got this whole piece around the necessary encounter. I just want to do a really quick caveat, right? A little kind of side issue here. How amazing is Daniel, okay? How amazing is Daniel? This is a great example of a guy who was on mission in his workplace. Can I just put it out there? So he was on mission in his workplace, and these Babylonians, they didn't even have the language. They didn't have the Christianese or the Yahwehese down, right, at the time. All they could say was that he has the spirit of the holy gods in him. They were using their language, but there was Daniel, and they appreciated him, and he was excellent at what he did. And when there was confusion, who do they call? Not Ghostbusters, Daniel. They call Daniel in. I say that as a caveat because I know a lot of you have jobs, right? What would it look like for you to be a Daniel in your work environment, right? They don't have to use the Christianese language, but they admire something in you. And when things go bad, they call on you. Anyway, caveat, we've got to jump back in. Verse 17, then Daniel answered the king. So they brought him in. You may keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. Now, I want to just take a note there, right? So the king, who was basically immersed in this arrogance that he had, was like, hey, if you can solve this, I'm going to give you all this glory, right? Now, Daniel's like, hey, I don't want what you've got. I don't want your disease, right? I don't want your purple robes and your bling and your status, okay? But I'll interpret what's going on here. I'll read the writing. Verse 18, Your Majesty, the Most High God, Your Majesty, the Most High God gave your father, Nebuchadnezzar, sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, all the nations and people of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. And those he wanted to humble, he humbled. But when his heart, now note this is Daniel talking about Nebuchadnezzar, Belteshazzar's father. But when his heart became arrogant, sound familiar, and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from people and was given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like the ox, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and sets over them anyone he wishes. Verse 22, and this is convicting. But you, Belshazzar, his son, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. You knew all this. Now, when we go back and we see that bit about, he's like, what, with the donkeys and he's eating grass? And yeah, literally, the historians would say he had essentially a mental breakdown, right? This isn't metaphor. This is like he actually went out and he ended up kind of operating as a bit of a crazy person outside until he humbled himself and he was brought back in. And Belshazzar knew this. This was his family. He knew the dangers of arrogance. He knew what would happen if he pursued that pathway. He knew. You knew, says Daniel. And so for Belshazzar, this was active rebellion. This was active rebellion against God because he knew. He'd seen what had happened to his father, and yet he hadn't learned the message. The lesson, that wasn't a word. He hadn't learned the lesson. He hadn't gotten the message, otherwise known as the message. And so he hadn't got that. And so he'd missed the point. And so therefore, God was actually having a necessary encounter with him. And this is why it comes back. The necessary encounter is always a response to the known. And I know this is a simple message. I'm just going to say it over and over and over again. But we need to understand there is stuff in our lives that we know is not of God. And the necessary, in as much as it is uncomfortable, as much as it is scary, is a response to that which is known. And this is genuinely one of the ways that God encounters us. Sometimes it's subtle. And sometimes, maybe like it was for Shaz, it's like a slap across the face. It might be a subtle way. It might be that you're just kind of at home. And suddenly, you know, maybe you just start getting kind of tempted, you know, to look at some pictures or to go online. And you start kind of being drawn toward temptation. And as you're on that kind of journey and you're like, and you know it's not right. Of course it's not right, right? It's not of God. It's not pure. It's not healthy. It's not what God wants for you. And as you're kind of pursuing that path, suddenly you get the phone call. And your phone rings and it almost shakes you. It stops you. And you're like, what the heck was I just about to do? Why was I going down that pathway? Or maybe, I know a few years ago, I remember I got an email and maybe I was less mature back then, I don't know. But I got this email, it was quite confronting. And I was like, this person is going down. And so I decided to craft an email and I'm writing out this email. And in this email, there was anger, right? There was frustration. And it was probably nothing to do with them, right? But I was writing out this email, I was slamming it out. I was confronting every single one of the accusations that they said. And I remember getting to the end of the email and going, this is going to kill. Which is a crazy thing for a pastor to say, isn't it? And then just before I was about to send it, I'm so grateful that an email popped up in my inbox from Mike Stevens, who was my boss at the time. It wasn't to do with the emails, just writing. He was just saying, hey, there's something I want to chat to you about. Can we have a conversation? And I was like, oh, all right. So I go in and have this conversation. And he's just like, you know what? I just felt compelled to send you an email. I just want you to know. And he had no idea what was going on, by the way. No idea. He's just, I just want you to know that, you know, when you get critique, and he was kind of reflecting on some of the critique he'd got in recent times. He's like, I know the best way to do it is just to have a conversation. Just to have a conversation. And I'm like, right. Good idea. Printed it off, put it in my drawer for later as a reminder. A reminder of the way that God uses a necessary encounter to avoid me heading down a pathway that would have resulted in more violence, more accusations, more fuel on the fire. Sometimes these are subtle ways that God captures our attention. Maybe it's we're waking up one day and we just feel like we're going to have a bad day. We're bringing in a bad attitude. This happens to me, right? I just wake up and I'm like, today is not going to be a good day. But then the lyrics of a worship song come to mind. Does anyone resonate with that? I don't know if you resonate with that. It happens to me all the time. The lyrics of a worship song come to mind and I can't shake them. I can't shake them. And anytime I'm wanting to make a bad decision or maybe use a harsh tone or something like that, I can't shake these lyrics that are in my mind. And it's almost like God is knocking me down and saying, don't head this way. And I haven't asked God for his attention. I haven't asked God to provide. He's just knocking me down and saying, don't go that way. You know where this will lead. And by his grace and by his provision, He necessarily encounters us. I wonder what it is for you. When you think about your life, when you think about those subtle ways that God catches your attention, catches you off guard, and maybe it scares you for a moment because suddenly you're confronted, just like Belshazzar was. But you know that God is doing it for your good. And sometimes we push through and we say we don't care, but other times we stop and we go, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for the pain and the fear that I just had, because I know it's for my best. It continues in verse 23. So you knew this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. This is what Daniel continues with Belshazzar. You have had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and your nobles and your wives and your concubines drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. You know how I mentioned that earlier? These things are useless. But you did not honor the Lord, the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. Therefore, he sent that hand that wrote the inscription, and the inscription that was written was many, many tekel parson, and it didn't have the vowels in it, which is why in the original writing they couldn't interpret it. And this is what these words mean. Many, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. And Perez, which is the plural of parson, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Now, I know you might look at this and kind of go, oh, but God is full of grace. Why didn't he give him a second chance? And, you know, we see many examples of God giving second chances. God is the God of the second chance. But in this particular case, there was something overwhelming that was occurring in Belshazzar's life. And the fact that he knew, he had seen, and there was this active rebellion against that which God had already showed him was wrong, meant that God's judgment in this case meant that his kingdom was going to be divided. And we read, actually, in a couple of verses later, in verse 29 to 31, then at Belshazzar's command, and notice this, okay, Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple, a gold chain was placed around his neck, and he was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Now, I just got to take note of this, right? Nothing changed. Can you hear? He just got this word of absolute conviction in Belshazzar. Nothing changed. He's still like, yeah, have the purple robe, have the bling, have the third highest position, which would soon become the second highest position. Nothing changed. This wasn't him just fulfilling a promise. This was like, okay, I know this, and I'm still going to just participate in what I'm doing. I'm still going to elevate that pride. See, the glory that Shaz had placed on himself resulted in verse 29 to 31. Sorry, we're going to go there again. In verse 30, that very night, Belshazzar, the king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. Now, Xenophon, the Greek historian, said that Belshazzar was murdered without resistance. He was murdered without resistance. That's what the Greek historian says. There was no resistance. Why? Because he was complacent and he was irreverent and he was performing idolatry and he just didn't think it would happen. You know, I wonder sometimes, and I know this is a confronting kind of statement, but I just want to kind of wrap up with this idea of the necessary encounter. I wonder sometimes what God is writing on our wall, on the wall of our lives, for our good. You know, sometimes I feel like, and maybe it's those simple and subtle moments, sometimes it's where he actually slaps us across the face. We thought we had something and he completely takes it away. You know, that can be a case of a necessary encounter. We had responsibility, he just takes it sometimes. Not always, but sometimes. But what is it that he's written on our wall? What is it that we know that God needs to confront through a necessary encounter? What is God writing on our wall for our good? It might be scary, it might be confronting, it might be challenging, it might be convicting, but there's things in our lives. Maybe it's just an unrestrained anger that we just can't settle down. Maybe it's issues around purity that is writing on our wall and convicting us of. Maybe it's around selfishness. And he's convicting us of these things. Maybe it's lying. It could be any of these things that we just kind of put to the side and we say, it's not such a big deal. And yet when God sees it, he says, I want to encounter you. I want to respond to that because that is heading you down a path like the path of Belshazzar. It's unhealthy. It cannot stay where it is. And I love how in the New Testament, when we see these same kind of necessary encounters, the one that just pops to mind is in John chapter 8, where the woman who was caught in an adultery was brought to Jesus. And all the people were going to accuse her, or were accusing her of what she had done. And she had done some wrong things. So had the guy who she'd been an adulteress to, but he wasn't there. But nevertheless, there she was, being convicted, being judged by the crowd. And there's something kind of beautiful about the fact that in the Old Testament, when God writes, one, he wrote on the Ten Commandments, and then Moses took them down the hill and the people were worshipping the calf and they got destroyed. And this other case of God writing was writing on the wall and ended up in Belshazzar's death. But in this story in John 8, as the people say, what do you say, Jesus? Do you condemn her? Jesus wrote on the ground and we don't even know what he wrote. But there's something beautiful about that reflection, right? And as he lifted his head, he said, let them one who has never sinned throw the first stone. And starting with the oldest, people began to leave, all the way to the youngest. And he wrote on the ground and looked up and said, hey, did anyone condemn you? She said, no, Lord, not even one. And he said, neither do I. Now go and sin no more. It wasn't that the sin wasn't serious. It's just that grace was even more serious. And I'm reminded of this because as we bring that which we want to remain hidden, that God writes on the wall and reminds us of, we ought to bring it with a heart of confession where we just lay it out there before Jesus in the knowledge that he is faithful, he is forgiving, that he wants to encounter us for our good. So I just want to invite you to close your eyes. And if you're brave enough, bring to mind, what is it that God is writing on my wall? What is that area of my life that I've wanted to remain hidden? And when God responds to that, when he convicts me of that, when he sheds light on that, when he uses people and opportunities to confront that, will I say, I'm sorry? Will I lay it before him? Will I accept what I have done and then accept his forgiveness? Because God wants to encounter us. And so, Lord, we bring these things to you and we say, do your work. We thank you for your grace. We thank you for your forgiveness. And we thank you for the way that you convict us through your Holy Spirit about that which isn't of you. And therefore lead us into the kind of life that truly is life. Because you love us. Because you're good to us. Because you know exactly what we need. In your mighty name we pray. Amen.